Accession number 18265, Reel 2.
Dave Brooks, Reel 2.
I started to look around for something suitable to jump in the water with, if I had to. First of all, we were near some sort of a dining room, and I thought, yes, I'll have one of those chairs, if it comes to it, wooden chairs. But then I spotted on the rail of the ship a very large life belt. So I thought, oh, that's even better. So I unhooked it and said to the chap next to me, we'll share this if we have to go in. Well, army people being what they are, soon spotted that I'd got this big life belt, so they started to take the mickey, and it took me a long time to live that down. They said, you remember old Brooko standing there with that bloody great life belt? But I said, you can say what you like. If I'm going in that water, I'm going in with something to hold me up. We had a detachment of Queen Alexandra nurses aboard Strathallan, something like 200 of them. And unfortunately, they were put into boats. Unfortunately, one of the boats they were in capsized, and I think five nurses lost their lives. They drowned, which was very unfortunate. But apart from that, I don't believe there was much loss of life, apart from these nurses. Most of the crew were Lascars. There was British officers, but most of the crew were Lascars, and apparently they had the right to have boats if they were hit. And when daylight came in the morning, only about four or five Lascars, all officers were left. All the rest had gone. Oh, I should say that. When we got on the to our boat station, the captain of the boat, who was a very bluff Englishman, very very bluff, he said something like, "Now hear this, you're making enough noise to wake Davy Jones. I'll have quiet," and he was using a lot of Anglo-Saxon, "or else, and get those bloody boats away from my ship," this is the lifeboats, "and get those people out of the water. Who ordered them in anyway?" Somebody lower down had told people to jump into the water, and they'd done so. But he was a most forthright man. What he wanted was silence. So all the rest of the convoy had gone. Very eerie, very quiet, and dark. But daylight came, and by now the ship was listing quite bad. It was quite difficult to walk on it if you wanted to walk anywhere. It was leaning at an angle. One or two of the Indian crew somehow raised some food as they brought round, and an ocean going tug arrived and got a line to us, but I remember that line kept snapping. It wouldn't hold. A couple of destroyers came up in the daylight, and I remember a big RAF flying boat made several passes by us, quite low, and one of the crew was hanging out of the window, and he was giving us a V sign, but he should have remembered that the V sign is given with the palm outwards, not the other way round. he was really taking the mickey. Some destroyers started to take off the people much lower down than us, and in the end it became our turn to get off, and we were so high up, and the destroyer being quite a low slung ship, they put nets down over the side of Strathallan, and you had to climb down them, and they put the destroyer stern on to the ship, and you jumped on the stern, and I know that the destroyer we got on was HMS Pathfinder. I know that because we made some inquiries a few years ago and traced the crew of the, or what was left of the crew of the Pathfinder. I must have been, Pathfinder, I think, took on 1,500 men on that boat. So you can imagine it was crowded. And I must have been one of the last down the net because I couldn't get any further. I was by the rear gun. There's a gun at the rear of the stern of the destroyer. That was officered by a petty officer who was quite fussy about you keeping clear of his gun in case he had to use it. And right at the last, when practically everybody was off Strathallan, it caught fire up through, a gush of flame roared up through the funnel, and the ship started to burn. And the petty officer said to me, "That's what you get for trying to raise steam," he said. I think everybody got off the ship, although the heat was so, it's so hot that you could literally see the paint blistering on the destroyer. You could literally see it bubbling. But we quickly cast off and pulled away, and then for an hour or two we circled. This by now was mid-afternoon. We circled Strathallan. It was just burning. And then another destroyer came up and took on the job of patrolling round and round Strathallan. I did hear afterwards, I know Strathallan sunk. I'm not sure whether it sunk of its own or whether the Navy put it down. Actually, you know, sunk it to get it out of the way. Pathfinder took us into Oran, newly taken by the Americans who landed there, and we were quickly put aboard SS Duchess of Bedford, and the next morning we made the quick run, it's only about 24 hours, up to Algiers, and we landed there. Taken from the port out to a village called Fort de Lou, and of course half of our people had lost most of our equipment. You'd certainly lost your rifles and all that sort of equipment, but we surprisingly quickly we were re-equipped. Some clothing was from the Americans, who their logistics are always so much better than the British. They've got so much money and things at their disposal. But oddly enough, a lot of people had their boots, which were boots and gaiters. Oh, and they were very popular. But they were quite quickly discarded as not being all that comfortable. The only thing that was retained was thought of value of American equipment was their pullover sweaters. They were very good quality and kept you warm. And then we weren't at Fort Duluth that long. While we were there, Darlan, Admiral Darlan, was assassinated. And I actually did see his funeral. It was one of those amusing things, really. The British escort for his funeral was a company of guards, and they can really put on the swank when they want to. But the main escorts were French. And their drill being different to our drill, and their band, their timing of the band was so different that the guards, in exasperation, they gave up trying to keep up with the French band and adopted their own gait, so that they were. And they were the only unit that I could see there that was anything like a military unit. You know, really, it was. But Darlan, of course, was he was Vichy France. But we couldn't have been. He must have been au fait with the British, because there was a danger when we first got to Algiers, whether the French would come in with us or oppose us. As it turned out, they all came over to us. All the troops that were in Africa, a lot of them were Arab troops, Spahis, Gooms, French Foreign Legion were there, but they all came over to us and supported us. But it was a little bit touch and go to start with, whether or not the French would resist. As soon as we were equipped, we were put on a train, and I think there's only one train line in Algeria up to Tunisia, and that took forever, days, not hours, days. And it seemed to me that every a village you came to on the railway line, the train crews stopped to take on timber to fire their boiler. Eventually we get up into Tunisia and we join the 2nd Battalion at Bija, a town in Algeria. I was assigned to B Company, and very shortly after that, we were in action. And in retrospect, I think the parachute brigade, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd battalions, were being used as a kind of a fire brigade in Tunisia to put out fires where they occurred. It took me a long time to twig on what we were doing in Tunisia, really, as we were part of the 1st Army, and the 8th Army was pushing up through the deserts. It was pushing the Africa Corps backwards all the time, and I concluded that our task really was to be the buffer to stop them going any further than Tunisia and actually stop them evacuating if they tried it. And I think most of the fighting in Tunisia hinged on roads. I have made a trip back to Tunisia and toured all the areas that I was in, and there's surprisingly few roads in that country. And I think the task of the first army out there was to stop the Africa Corps funneling back and getting away, as it were. Well, we saw action in many. We stomped all over Tunisia, Medjez El Bab, Longstop Hill, Green Hill, Jebel Ali Gila. We were frequently in action, but not really losing that many men. Not really losing very men. And
can you describe any of the battles you were in?
Yes, I can. We spent the longest period we spent there was 3 weeks or so in a place called the Bourada Valley, which was on the Goubalet Plain, very fertile area of Tunisia. The First Brigade was so stretched out there that it was absolutely ridiculous, really. We operated section by section. And to my mind, the second battalion occupied a front miles long, because the next section to us was a quarter of a mile away or more. But this area was relatively quiet. There'd be a few shells daily, but my section was tucked into a wadi where we'd dug slit trenches. We had with us, lower down the wadi, a French manned anti-tank gun, manned by four men. I can remember a couple of the names there. The corporal of the gun was George Jalbi, who was Tunisian. He'd been a Tunisian policeman in Tunis, and there was also a Tunisian Arab who was in the French army, Abdul Hamid, who, within the time we were together, he was a very smart lad. He picked up English enough to make himself understood, and he was the guy that, to augment your rations, he could wander off and go to the Arab people and come back with eggs and a chicken or two. Thoroughly likeable lad he was, and he learnt English so quickly that it was unbelievable. Unbelievable it was. Well, most of the activity there was patrol activity. You'd be out on patrol, a couple of times a week, and most of them were all of them really were observation patrols, where you went out probing to try to find out what the Germans were doing. Sometimes you'd spot them. Sometimes it was nothing, until eventually a division came to attack us, and you could see them because it was a rolling plain. You could see the movement of the troops. It turned out to be a combined Austrian and Italian division. Well, they got near enough to us for our mortars to open up, and that immediately put them down, and you could actually see through your binoculars their officers trying to get them up to go on, and they wouldn't. Night time came, and C Company sent out a fighting patrol, a platoon strong, just over the ridge. There was a lot of noise, a lot of firing, a lot of shouting. C Company actually came back with 80 prisoners, which is really silly when you think of it. When daylight came, we thought, well, now we're going to catch it. It's going to get a bit hot.
Which company were you in?
B Company. Now it's going to get a bit warmed up, but it didn't transpire. That whole division more or less packed up. They were coming over every little hillock on the plain with valises. Some even had cases. They were with white flags. They were surrendering, which was just as well, really, because of the way we were strung out. We really were occupying a hell of a long front, but they packed up. Something else happened at Burrada, which is worth talking about. As I was a corporal, I used to lead quite a number of these patrols, which were quite specific in its instructions of what you're going to do. And one day the mail came up, and part of my mail was a letter from my mother telling me that my brother next to me, younger brother, had been killed flying with the Air Force on New Year's Eve 1942. Well, that day I really did have murder in my heart. I really did. I was leading a patrol that night, observation patrol, and the men coming with me had already been selected. But during the day, I found that my mood had been ascertained by friends of mine, and the patrol was changed to three mates of mine: Fred Martin, Bill Bacon, Ron Moon, who I'd served with in the West Kents. And they just said to me, "We're coming out with you tonight, Dave." I didn't argue with them, but I know what their object was. They were going to stop me doing anything stupid. Well, as it turned out, while we were out, the rains came. And in Tunisia, when you get rains come, it rains heavy. So we went out, did our observations, saw nothing, found nothing. We came back like drowned rats. But I hadn't done anything stupid. The point of that story is all three of those people came with me, Bill, Ron, and Fred, all lost their lives quite shortly afterwards. And on the night of which I tell you this partly to illustrate that frontline soldiers are not, they don't really like killing. They don't really like it. But they're doing it. They're doing the job, but they don't really like it. And those three blokes were going to prevent me doing anything stupid. But they were all to lose their lives. And during the night where we had stopped this Austrian-Italian division, we were doing a lot of patrolling around our own area, and Bill Bacon, one of the men that came with me, caught two prisoners, one an Austrian sergeant major. But again, Bill was a very, very good boxer, very good. He knocked the sergeant major out rather than use a weapon and took the other one prisoner. It's another illustration that we weren't all that keen on killing. And Bill, two or three weeks later, was to lose his life. Anyway, from Buerada, we'd been in the line now quite a long time, 2 months or more, and it's quite hard trying. You've never had a proper bed, you've never had proper meals. It's all composite rations, which don't do your stomach any good. It keeps you alive, keeps you going, but it's not a good diet. We were going to be relieved, and we were relieved this time by an American unit. Well, Americans weren't really very good in North Africa. They were learning the ropes of war, and they take their time learning, Americans do. They'd been given a number of positions in Tunisia, which had been taken by the British, and they lost them. They really did. And the British had to go in and retake them again. Anyway, this unit turned up. We, in our wadi, we were a section strong, 10 men, plus the French anti-tank gun crew. They turned up with 30 men. And their officer said, there's not enough slit trenches for us here. And our sergeant said, well, you'll have to dig them like we did. You'll have to dig more, you know. And I said to a couple of the soldiers were sitting up on the edge of the wadi, and I said, I wouldn't sit there if I was you. We've been here some time. As far as I know, we've never been spotted, never. And you'd be wise to come down inside the wadi and keep yourself hidden. But they were typical Americans, brash.